It's with great sadness that I learned just this morning that Dr. Shabir Akhtar has passed away. He was truly a great philosopher, a Muslim intellectual, and a friend. I've been in almost daily contact with him over the last several years, thinking how long have we been talking? I mean, it must be about 4 or 5 years now, mostly interacting about theology and history and philosophy, Christianity, Islam, contemporary events. And I'm going to miss him. I'm already missing him dearly. I'm still trying to process this this tremendous loss for the Muslim Ummah, actually. As the Quran says, surely to Allah we belong, and to him we will all return. Now, as I say, this is a momentous loss for the Muslim Ummah and the intellectual world. And one of the things that struck me about his work, which is his legacy, I think, is how seriously underrated he was as a thinker. But back to the man he was. Shabir was, believe it or not, a son of a bus driver from Bradford, but he had an exceptional intellect. He got a PhD at Cambridge University. I think the subject was Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher. And through his work subsequently, he inspired many people through his groundbreaking writings, and certainly including myself. And today, as I say, we hear that he has joined his maker. His death is a great loss, an enormous loss to the Muslim world. And I just want to take this opportunity in this tribute to him to emphasize what his legacy, which I think is what his legacy will be, and that is his extraordinary books. And I want to pay tribute to him as a Muslim intellectual, as a philosopher, as a writer, as a man of exceptional lucidity. His ability with words was, and his sharpness of wit was almost unparalleled, absolutely extraordinary. And I just want to share with you some of his words from three of his books. He wrote many more, but three of my favorite books are of his, which I recommend everyone to read. The first one, perhaps his less known work, perhaps, I don't know, is this one, the New Testament in Muslim Eyes, Paul's Letter to the Galatians by Shabir Akhtar. This man, Shabir, knew New Testament Greek. He knew Hebrew. He knew Arabic. Obviously, he knew English. He was a true polymath, a man who was a master in many fields. And he was competent as to be a New Testament scholar as well. And in the introduction, there's some words from Paul Feeds, his professor of systematic theology, Oxford University, praising this remarkable book. He calls it, this commentary is remarkable, provocative, and essential reading. And that is from a top scholar in the field of Christian theology. And I just want to read just a couple of passages from it, just for the sheer delight of relishing Shabir's ability to articulate complex subjects in accessible language. And his works are advanced, by the way. They're not really easy reading, but they repay study and perseverance, I think. And just pretty randomly here on page seven, he has these, and occasionally I think he enjoyed making controversial comments. And some of what I'm going to read now is controversial. I may or may not agree, but usually I do agree with him, to be honest. But whether or not you agree with him is not really the point. I just want you to appreciate the mind, the man behind these words. And he just says in the introduction to this book on Paul's letter to the Galatians, as a Muslim writing a New Testament commentary, if we exclude the Russian landmass, Europe is geographically the least among the traditionally delineated continents. In other words, it's the smallest of all the continents in the world, really. Yet it colonized and evangelized virtually the entire globe. And Paul is the Apostle Paul, the author of much of the New Testament. And Paul is, for better or worse, in my considered judgment, the most influential European. I think he's right. Neither Constantine nor Charlemagne, neither Aristotle nor his pupil Alexander can compete with the enduring potent legacy of Paul's life and actions. The Apostle Paul of Tarsus made the Semitic temperament in religion part of the European temperament in general. Pauline Christianity is the nursery of the European character for some 1.5 millennia, the entire lifespan of Islam. Even secularized post-Christian Europeans, especially Marxists and secular liberals, are messianic in outlook. This is a brilliant insight. They zealously spread their message to the whole world, though they mistake a fashionable Eurocentric cosmopolitanism for an authentic universality, confusing their own local affluence and good fortune for a global condition, end quote. That's quite damning, really. Great rhetoric, pungent, witty, great rhetoric. Another quote, that's what I quickly read from this book, his New Testament commentary. And he actually talks about Islamic themes as well from time to time. And they're the juicy bits where he brings into contrast and juxtaposition Islamic themes and Christian theology, which is not surprising given that the author is a Muslim. And I'm about to read you a quote about Sufism, which is controversial. I mean, his comments are controversial, whether or not you agree with them. But I'm offering this up just as a tribute to his brilliance, whether or not we actually think he is right. And he writes as follows on page 108. Islamic Sufism is a heterodox development, in effect, a Christianization of early Islam. Whatever the details of its historical genesis as a reaction against the luxury and excesses of imperial Islam, Muhammad was not, contrary to what modern Muslim apologists in the West claim, a mystic who accidentally founded an empire. He was a saint general who feared an independent and judgmental God. Muhammad never saw himself as dwelling in God or the deity dwelling in him. If that is mysticism, a commingling of the supernatural and natural, he was no mystic. The Muslim mystics were, on the other hand, eager to obliterate any spiritual distinction between themselves and God, keen to identify themselves with him in some coherent sense. But, writes Shabir, and he quotes the Quran, Muhammad is merely the messenger of God. Quran 48:29. No messenger is literally part of the one who sends him, no matter how closely aligned their wills and intentions. And he continues, mysticism inevitably deteriorates into a falsely religious and therefore ultimately mawkish and thus falsely sentimental version of an otherwise authentic religion. When I first read that sentence, I remember rushing off thinking, mawkish, what's that word mean? You know. So mysticism, he says, degenerates into a mawkish and sentimental version of an authentic religion. Very controversial stuff. The removal of law is a retrograde step in the evolution of religion, because he's now back to Paul. I admit, however, that Paul never denied in practice or in theory the goodness of the good law of the good God of Israel and Moses. He merely denied its power to save sinners. But that does not appear to be the view held by his opponents, whether Jews or Jewish Christians. Another question here, no less important, is whether or not Paul relaxed his own conscientious observance of the law to the point of virtual apostasy from its scruple and minutiae. So there's a double blast there against Sufism and Paul. And at the very, very end of this book, in the epilogue, he does actually talk about his own views. And he does view Paul as a virtual apostate from Judaism. He's quite harsh about Paul. But in the main body of the commentary on the letter to Paul's letter to Galatians, I think he's very scholarly, as this professor at Oxford said of it, a remarkable and acute guide. So that's a couple of paragraphs from this marvelous book. If you're Muslim and you're interested in the Bible, Christian theology, New Testament studies, and the extraordinary influence of this man, Paul, who wrote these letters, then this is a must-have for your library. You will not regret buying it. Now, a couple of other books, my favorites. This one, Islam as Political Religion, The Future of an Imperial Faith by Shabir Akhtar. Now, I often used to speak to Shabir about this, and he was, I have to say, he was often angry that this book had never been reviewed by anyone in any academic journal, in any newspaper, or anything. It had been studiously ignored by the Western intelligentsia. And the question is why it's been ignored. I read this book several times. Marvelous work. It is an uncompromising defense of Islam as a political religion. So there's no attempt here to pretend, in his view, that Islam is completely compatible with secularism and liberal democracy. He doesn't think it is, really. And I suspect that his ability to very fluently articulate his case in Western language and concepts made it a very, very threatening book, because, you know, he really defends Islam, the traditional sense of Islam. He's not pretending you can, as some Muslim scholars do, who I've met, mentioning no names, that you can have a liberal Islam, that you can have a politically liberal democratic Islam. He would have none of that. So it is a controversial book, but it deserves to be taken seriously. Soon Islam will be the biggest religion in the world. And its political understanding of the social system, the social order, really needs to be understood, not in a way that's revisionist and liberalized, but in its traditional form. And this book will give you that in unapologetic terms. And I just want to read to you a paragraph from this. I mean, I could almost open this book at random. It's so full of really well-expressed sentiments. Whether or not you agree with him is not really my argument, although a lot of the time I think his arguments are compelling. It's how he expresses himself, and this is his legacy, I think, to us, his great contribution to Muslim thought and the Ummah. He says on page 132, "The Quran's attempt to sanctify the political dimension of life, its decision to incorporate power into Islam's originating ideals, explains classical Islam's tolerant ascendancy and humanity. Rulers enforce the judicial principle of al-dima, the protection of monotheistic communities, mentioned only once in the Quran, along with a single reference to the protection tax as the jizya in Surah 9, verse 29. The principle is enshrined in the Prophet's practice. He pledged protection and honorable treatment for Jews and Christians. Being a Quranic imperative, the legal protection of Jews and Christians was, for Muslim rulers, a duty, not a merit." In other words, they weren't doing it because they were nice and they wanted to be good. It was an obligation on the Muslim rulers, because it says so in the Quran, of course, and in the Sunnah. "Hence," he says, "we have the haven created by imperial Islam," so he's defending imperial Islam, "for communities of Jews, Eastern Christians, and religious refugees fleeing from a Christian Europe steeped in violently intolerant enthusiasms. When Catholicism was reimposed in Andalusia," this is in Spain, "Jews usually preferred migration to Muslim lands. We can imagine their alternative fate if medieval Muslims had abdicated their political obligations by pleading indifference to temporal power." So he's here saying it's a good thing Muslims were concerned with temporal power, because they managed to save Jewry, basically. "Present Christian and Western unease," now back to our time, "present Christian and Western unease about Islam as political religion is informed by specifically European experiences of theocratic rule. Just as the Christian experience of religious government has been invariably toxic, the Muslim experience of secular administration imposed by Western powers has been even worse. Under the Ottoman regime, the longest lasting dynasty in history and a genuinely Islamic order for all its defects, the Middle East experienced no major conflict for 400 years from 1517 to 1917. This is remarkable. That is the longest period of continuous peace for the Holy Land. Since 1917, however, secular colonial modernity, imposed in myriad forms, has presided over the unrest for which the region is now a byword. End quote. And we all know what that's about. I'm not going to go there. So this is extraordinary, the way he's framing this. Really, really interesting. So that is Islam. I recommend this book extremely highly if you want a good education in the politics of Islam, Islam as a political entity. Fascinating. And lastly, my favorite book of all time by Shabir is this book, of course. I'm sure you know, The Quran and the Secular Mind, A Philosophy of Islam. And this book blew my mind when I first read it. I first heard of it because Abdul Hakim Murad, otherwise known as Tim Winter, the Cambridge academic and Muslim convert, recommends this particular book in his recommended reading list. And he has it in three categories: advanced, intermediate, and introductory. This book is in the advanced category. And yes, it is an advanced work. So I'm not recommending someone who knows like nothing about philosophy to read it. It's a very challenging but very meaty book, and it's not necessarily easy to read if you're not used to his style of writing. And Shabir, I've got to mention, was actually on the faculty at Oxford University, sadly passed away, but he was an Oxford academic, although his PhD was from Cambridge University in the philosophy of Kierkegaard. And in conclusion, I just want to read this passage from the book, because it helped to really influence my thinking on how to frame the narrative when it comes to Islam and science, Islam and all that, Islam, what it says about the afterlife, the supernatural, God, jinn, angels, demons, the afterlife, and science. How do we bring these worlds, these two metaphysical realities, into relationship with each other? And Shabir, in his book, I think, is able to reconcile these two brilliantly. I don't mean that they are made harmonious, but he's able to order and stratify these different discourses in a way that I find spiritually and intellectually satisfying for me. That's what he did. So I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs where he actually discusses this and I think brilliantly pulls this off. The language is difficult. I make no apology for that, just warning you. I've read these passages many, many times, and for me, they're now very familiar. But the language is difficult, but I think it is warranted given the complexity of the subject. And he's talking about the Quran and science. So he says on page 169, the Quranic, like the biblical worldview, conflicts with the scientific perspective, which assumes, this is really controversial, so he's admitting science and religion conflict, but hang on, it's not quite his last word on the subject. Okay, it conflicts with the scientific perspective, which assumes that the cosmos is a self-contained set of patterned empirical sequences, intelligible to us in terms of natural causality. The spatial-temporal continuum is subject to discoverable lawful regularity. Recently, probability laws, couched in statistical terms, replace the older laws of causality as physical indeterminacy complicated the picture at the subatomic level. In other words, put very simply, Einstein replaced Isaac Newton without getting to all of that. A metaphysic of events now supplants the older metaphysic of natural objects or substances uncomplicatedly locatable in three-dimensional space. Remember the billiard balls on the table, atoms bouncing off each other, they're very kind of three-dimensional. Now under Einstein, we have a very different picture, as you know. We have, you know, to do with a metaphysic of processes and probabilities rather than fixed events. Anyway, enough about me. A metaphysic of events now supplants the older metaphysic of natural objects or substances uncomplicatedly locatable in three-dimensional space. But nature remains autonomous and self-sustaining. So despite all of this, for the scientist, in practice, nature is autonomous and self-sustaining. You can see where the conflict lies, can't you? Islam, however, posits an additional supernatural realm and denies the autonomy of nature. Boom, he goes in, boom. And he refers to Quran 35:41. Directly, actively, and continuously, God sustains the world after creating it. He prevents the lowest heaven, our sky, from collapsing on sinful humanity. And he references this with quotes from the Quran, which I won't repeat. He arranges the clouds, directs the winds that give rain and revive the dead earth, holds the birds poised in mid-air, and keeps the two seas separate. The Quranic cosmology presupposes continuous interaction between the natural causal world and the supranatural realm of occult causality. Now, this is one of my favorite sentences in this book because it's chock-a-block with punchy, meaningful metaphysics. So the cosmology of the Quran presupposes the interaction between, as he says, the natural world, so-called, and the supernatural realm of occult causality. Occult meaning it's hidden. We don't see the action of God. We don't see literally see the action of God in the world. We just don't see it in cause and effect. But it's there, hidden, but present in its effects. I think that's what he's saying. He goes on, supernatural agents routinely act within and interpenetrate the natural world of empirical causality. What does he mean? He goes on. The jinn, he says, elemental spirits found in the intricate nexus of Arabic poetry, possession and madness, are integral to the pre-Islamic outlook and remain part of modern Islam. Indeed, Iblis, the devil, is a jinn created from fire. His arrogant free will led him to freely reject God's rule. He is an actively malicious agent in human history. So I love the way he interconnects here. He brings these different dimensions into relationship with one another. Modern science, modern historiography, of course, separate out God's realm, the supernatural, the influence of angels and the devil, all systematically excluded, and thus reducing reality to a very kind of materialist metaphysic, which he obviously Shabir thought was completely wrong, as indeed do I, and any Muslim would say the same, of course. So the devil is actively and maliciously an agent in human history. God too, he says, is active. He shapes the embryo in the womb as he pleases and removes the souls of sleepers at night, so that each day is a fresh resurrection as the souls of those destined to live are returned to life until an appointed hour. In the spiritual interaction between the two worlds, human petition, prayer, piety, pure speech, and good deeds ascend to the unseen world. He then concludes, this picture is incompatible with empirical science. Absolutely. Modern scientists feel obliged to reject on principle. What principle is this? The principle of materialism, I suppose. On principle, the possible existence of God, the devil, indeed obliged to reject indeed all spirits, including those of the departed dead, the jinn, demons, angels, and other immaterial or incorporeal entities lacking space-time coordinates, end quote. I could go on and on reading this, but I love the way he juxtaposes and intermingles this language of demons, angels, and then talks about how they lack space-time coordinates. In other words, they're not open, they're not amenable to so-called scientific explanation, which is committed to an empirical, observable reality. So that's a difficult passage to read out, but I love it because it helped to frame, as I say, my own understanding in a much clearer way of the relationship between the Quranic worldview and the biblical worldview, which is very similar, and science itself. Shabir was an exquisite writer, and I've always been surprised that his work has not been more widely discussed and circulated, and it's a huge loss that we have today that in his sad passing. May Allah forgive him his sins, award him according to the best of what he did, and grant him paradise. Amen.